Welcome to the Heroic Investing Show. As first responders, we risk our lives every day. Our financial security is under attack. Our pensions are in a state of emergency. A single on-duty incident can alter or erase our earning potential instantly and forever. We are the heroes of society. We are self-reliant and we need to take care of our own financial future. The Heroic Investing Show is our toolkit of business and investing tactics on our mission to financial freedom.
Hello and welcome to the Heroic Investing Show. Thank you so much for joining me. This is episode 120. On this show, we focus on unique challenges faced by members of the armed services and first responders, those firefighters, EMTs, police officers that put themselves in harm's way to protect the rest of us so that we can seek out, perfect, and share with the world our unique genius. But listen, these first responders, and certainly those of us that are veterans and retirees, are looking for an additional income or perhaps finally to be able to take out of the garage that business, that vision that we have of sharing something that makes us passionate, something that we lose track of time when we're doing it, our own little idea, our business, our investing purpose. For some of us, it is real estate, but for most of us, real estate passive cash flow is simply just the thing that allows us to step off the treadmill, step away from that earned income job, those crazy long hours of double shifts and deployments to be able to focus on what really does inspire us. And listen, I have friends who are teaching grade school, who are teaching high school, who are traveling around on a speaker circuit, who are starting up small businesses, or simply kicking back and watching the sunrise. It is absolutely up to you, but I believe that each of us has inside something that we want to perfect, that we want to share with the world, and that the world is going to appreciate and compensate us for it. So that's what drives me, is to help others find their unique genius. But more importantly, most of us know where it is. We just don't have the confidence to go after it. So someone else who does that is Jason's guest on this 10th episode. So 120 is the 10th episode. And as you know, on this and his other shows, Jason goes off topic with something of general interest. We've gotten rave reviews on, he's gotten rave reviews on Creating Wealth and Jet Setter and all the other ones he runs. But I've received similar feedback on the Heroic Investing Show. And what I do often is go back into the archives and find one that is of timeless value. And that's what I'm doing on this one. This is a discussion with Heidi Grant Halvorsen on motivation and success. So the actual title is The Hard Science of Success and Motivation. And Heidi is a psychologist, a researcher, a professor, and a pretty prolific writer now, columnist for different magazines and shows. Her focus, having researched this as a practicing psychologist and professor, is to determine, you know, what techniques scientifically get humans to be truly successful. And by that, she means, you know, how they feel successful, right? Because success is in large part in our minds. You know, we define success by our perspective, our goals. And sometimes we get a little distracted by trying to keep up with the Joneses and feel we're not successful just because we're looking around and we see the best of somebody else's life on Facebook or your next door neighbor taking a trip that you're not taking. We get into a kind of tunnel vision. We get in a very small world and we don't perhaps open our perspective to recognize that the very poor in America, 99.9% of Americans would be considered wealthy in some other country, many places in Africa and South America and Asia. It's just that we have a different perspective here in America and maybe some different standards, but it's really just about maintaining perspective. You know, we would all be considered super wealthy and have riches beyond those of any king, you know, 50 years ago or 500 years ago. There were very few people. I mean, John F. Kennedy, when he was looking to put a man on the moon, did not have all of the world's knowledge at his fingertips in his pocket like you and I do today and those that are unemployed in America do. So I think maintaining perspective, I didn't mean to get off on too much of a rant there, but maintaining perspective is super important. I lose perspective all the time. I went to a community mastermind event last week. It was for individuals in the insurance, you know, profession, more traditional, foundational way of growing wealth. And in that mastermind, I was commenting that, man, sometimes things get really stressful when you're trying to grow your business and going in too many directions at once. So, you know, I'm certainly susceptible to this as everyone else is. So I feel that because this is in our minds, we all know how to set goals. We all know how to write them out in long-term vision, short-term steps. But if you're not reminded of what those goals are, meaning write them down and put them in front of you, and don't have some way to hold yourself accountable to stay on track, you often, you know, get lost. And really, I think that's why many of you are out there searching for this. You know, first of all, we don't really, I think, recognize that perhaps success is not building a large sum of money. You know, Jason, Patrick Donahoe at Paradigm Life, and all of my friends that joined me as prosperity economics advisors in a group called the Prosperity Economics Movement believe that it has more to do with cash flow than it does building a big nest egg. Because one challenge is that nest egg always needs to be bigger and bigger and bigger, because when you get there, it becomes normal and you start to feel, you know what? What if this happens and that happens and a big correction happens at the same time something happens with one of my properties, for example? And we think, you know what? I need to push a little bit further and a little bit further, because we're looking for consistent cash flow from a big nest egg, from a big net worth number. And that's not ever consistent unless you take back control and you have the ability to judge and determine when cash flow is and is not vulnerable to loss. And so if it's just a nest egg, you're probably never going to be there. And that's a lesson that I learned. With cash flow, much more comfortable, much more dependable, and I believe it sets us up for a path in which we can step away from a job that perhaps we don't want or are tired of or can no longer perform and step into that thing that is our unique genius. So, you know, does success and fulfillment mean achieving status and physical accomplishments? Is it a large nest egg? Well, the keys, I think, are being very specific about what success means to you. And as I said, writing them down and revisiting them, and things like this podcast. You know, I believe this is why you're searching for this podcast and Patrick's The Wealth Standard and others like that, where we have people in front of us while we're doing our other activities and listening to these podcasts, driving down the road or mowing the lawn. We have put in front of us, again, reminders of new techniques or different ways to try to help ensure success from things that we know we need to do, like set goals. So I believe that continuing to listen to these and continuing to present them to you, my audience, helps us find that one thing that gets through our shell in this busy world we live in, and perhaps helps our goals and our missions stick, and helps our activities, more importantly, towards those goals that we know we need to do, help those stick so they get down that path. And to that vein, I'm going to pass over here to Jason and Heidi and make sure I actually go to the gym today to get myself back on a track that I personally fell off of while on a bunch of travel here recently. So thanks so much. I hope you get great value out of this. Back with many more episodes later this week.
My pleasure to welcome Heidi Grant Halverson to the show. She is the author of Succeed, How We Can Reach Our Goals. And unlike so many people talking about this subject out there, Heidi is a research scientist. So we're going to hear about some real hard science today and how it applies to motivation and how we can live more successful lives. Heidi, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, our pleasure to have you. So where are you located, by the way?
I spend my time sort of between New York City and Easton, Pennsylvania.
Fantastic. Well, so you are a research scientist in the subject, the field of human motivation. What do you do every day? I mean, what I don't understand what would be your typical day?
Well, you know, a typical day involves things like, you know, conducting experiments. What is, I think, different about the approach that I take to motivation from, say, you know, a lot of the other kind of advice that you get out there from people is that, you know, much of that advice is just personal, right? So someone who's very successful says, this worked for me, this didn't work for me, so that's my advice to you. The approach we take is really to take a step back and say, okay, sort of objectively, let's look at 100 people trying to lose 10 pounds. Let's look at 100 people trying to get a promotion. And let's look at what they do, and let's look at who succeeds and who fails, and try to figure out, you know, what the difference is. And the differences usually have to do with things like the strategies they use to try to reach their goals. And so we're able to identify, oh, that's a strategy that works, and that's a strategy that doesn't. So we kind of by taking a little bit of a step back, you kind of get a better sense of sort of what works for everybody, not just, you know, sort of what works for one person, but what seems to be sort of principles that you can really kind of count on. And then you can apply those principles in your own life to be more successful. And one of the things that we find is that, you know, our intuitions about success and failure and what makes someone successful or not are tend to be really wrong. You know, there are lots of areas in psychology where kind of common sense tells you basically how something works. This is not one of them. You know, we feel like we know what makes someone successful. We feel like we know why we were successful sometimes and at other times not. And many times our answers are just wrong. And we know that by kind of, again, taking a step back, looking at hundreds and hundreds of people and seeing what the success stories have in common and what the failure stories have in common. And often they're not the things that you would intuitively think, you know, are the reasons. So it's a different kind of approach, but what I like about it is it's fairly, you know, it's an evidence-based approach. And so what I do on most days is, you know, design studies to try to kind of isolate these things, to try to say, you know, I wonder if this strategy would be a good strategy. And then you try to design a study that really tests that idea by having people use that strategy in the lab or in the classroom or in the workplace and see if it works for them.
So then your academic training, I mean, you were a professor, mm-hmm. or are you mm-hmm. a professor now, one or the
well,
other?
Well, I've been a professor now. I'm actually at the Columbia Business School. I'm the associate director of the Motivation Science Center there. So I used to do a lot more teaching. Now I'm mostly focused on doing research and then writing about, you know, a big part of what I do these days has to do with sort of taking what we learn in these experiments, in these various studies, and kind of translating them into English so that people can actually use them. So I spend a lot of my time these days writing for different kinds of outlets. I write for the Harvard Business Review a lot and Forbes, trying to kind of get people to learn about this stuff so they can use it to actually improve.
And I should also say you write for Fast Company.
That's right.
You blog for them, the Huffington Post, Psychology Today, and you're a regular contributor to the BBC's World Service Business Daily. So that's fantastic. Now, so is your academic background then in psychology or statistics,
right.
or I mean, it would seem like you'd have to know statistics too.
It's in psychology. We learn a fair amount about statistics just to be able to do our jobs. But my PhD is in psychology, and my area of specialization is motivation. So I've always been interested in sort of questions having to do with, you know, why do some people, when you do something that's difficult, that's really challenging, why do some people, you know, withdraw and they feel helpless in the face of difficulty while other people sort of kind of dig deep and, you know, experience it as a challenge and then really kind of rise to the occasion? And, you know, how are those two kinds of people different from each other? The interesting thing is that, you know, what you might think, something like, oh, that maybe one is smarter than the other, it turns out not to be the case. IQ does not predict anything about how someone handles difficulty. So it tends to be these more sort of psychological variables, our beliefs about ability, the kinds of goals we set for ourselves, the mindset that you have when you're approaching a goal, the strategies, as I said, that you use when you're trying to reach it, that really actually spell out the difference between success and failure.
So before, you know, we're going to drill down into this, Heidi,
mm-hmm.
but let's, I mean, I think before we start, we have to define success. And of course,
right.
that means something different to everybody, but the general Western idea of success, I think it would be fair to say, is economic success, mostly. It's the most visible, it's the most quantifiable mode
mm-hmm.
of success. But of course, there are many other definitions and areas of success. How do you define success?
Well, in the work that I do and other people do in this area, we tend to define it sort of in the eye of the beholder. It really doesn't, in many cases, matter what the kind of goal is that you're pursuing. It just matters that you have a goal, and then we kind of figure out what works. Because surprisingly, the things that tend to work trying to lose, the strategies you would use trying to lose weight, are often, in many cases, the same strategies, motivational strategies, you would use trying to keep your finances in order or get along better with your spouse or remember to call your mother, whatever the goal is, you know, oftentimes the same kinds of strategies are useful. Now, having said that, and you know, that success is very much I think, personal. It has everything to do with being successful at the goals you choose, and they're going to be determined, of course, by your experiences and your values. I would say, on top of that, there is really quite a bit of research showing that some goals are better than others, and if by better you mean better able to give us sort of a lasting sense of well-being and happiness. It turns out accumulating money for the sake of just accumulating more of it, fame, popularity, power, these kinds of goals, which are, by the way, the goals most of us pursue all the time, really actually tend to not predict. I mean, everybody's happy when they reach the goal, but they don't necessarily predict lasting happiness as well as goals that we kind of think of as ones that satisfy our sort of basic human needs. So things like feeling connected to other people, feeling competent, you know, being able to use your skills and to develop new ones, and feeling autonomous, which is kind of basically saying that you get to choose what you do and your choices reflect who you are, your values, your preferences. You know, they feel kind of like authentically you. When people set goals that kind of get to those feelings of connectedness, feelings of competence, and feeling that they're kind of doing things that are chosen because they speak to them personally, those are the goals that when you reach them seem to lead to a much sort of deeper and longer lasting happiness. That's not to say that the other goals aren't good, and of course often it's the case that you need to be concerned about making money in order to maybe do some of these other things that you want to do that are kind of more, you know, so they're interrelated, you know.
Sure, they are. They are interrelated. That's a very good point. So a couple comments on that, and let's just talk about kind of the money thing first, if we can, yeah, you know, for a minute here, because that is so visible and quantifiable, and in the Western world, most people have their basic needs met. They're moving up Maslow's hierarchy, and, you know, they've got the basics taken care of, fortunately. I mean, thankfully, that of course is becoming maybe less true nowadays in this time of economic hardship where you've got, you know, you see tent cities around the U.S. and homelessness rates and so forth. But by and large, anybody listening to this show has their basic needs met. And they're striving beyond that to move up that rung. And so money does create independence to some extent, and that feeling of being autonomous and being able to make one's own choices in life is a freedom, and that creates a sense of well-being and happiness, right?
Absolutely.
Now, some of the studies I've read about money, like whether prosperity really, the old saying is, you know, money can't buy happiness. And
right.
What I say to that is it buys more happiness than poverty does.
Right. Yes, it does. That is certainly true.
Yeah. It doesn't solve problems. It just creates new sets of problems, and it maybe makes the stuff that's less pleasant in life. You know, you can hire other people to do that stuff that you don't want to do. So there is maybe some freedom and independence in that.
I think you're absolutely right in that idea that you mentioned before, that sort of having money frees you to make autonomous choices, is I really think a big part of it. I mean, it becomes about what you do with it. You know, the studies that look at the relationship between wealth and happiness, they do show that there is, you do have to get to a certain level before you're not miserable, because obviously poverty is very bad. You know, but then sort of like what happens beyond that? What happens beyond when my needs are met? And which is really the interesting space. Now, what the data seems to show is that there isn't a really reliable relationship between what happens after the needs are met. So you're accumulating more wealth, and you're not necessarily happier. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people in that, you know, that's on average. And I think that there are people in that are, in fact, happier because they have more money, because of what they're doing with it, that they are using that money in ways that allows them to, like I said, sort of satisfy these other needs, satisfy that, you know, be able to the freedom to make choices, the freedom to pursue the things that you find interesting in life and rewarding, the freedom to have time to be with people you want to have connections with. And there is, of course, a feeling of achievement, you know, there's something to be said for that too. Someone who is really excellent at what they do, that is also very satisfying and leads to greater well-being. And so there's a kind of a satisfaction there that's less about the money and more than just the, like, wow, I'm really good at this, and that feels really good. I do think that it's too simplistic to say money doesn't buy you happiness. And it really is more about making wise choices about what that money affords you to do. And when people get too wrapped up in just making the money for the sake of making the money, and they're not really attending to these other needs, that's when you're going to find people that aren't happy. And that's why you find sort of on average, people aren't happier, because there's a lot of people that kind of aren't doing it right.
Yeah, so the things I've read about that, you know, I remember reading a really interesting study maybe 5-6 years ago, and it talked about the prosperity issue, and it talked about different countries and then within the U.S., and there was a lot of stuff about this out at that time. Maybe it was one of your studies, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
but it basically said that in the United States, and of course this is for a person who's into their 40s and older than that probably, but in the United States, if you could put a number on it in terms of a net worth number, they came to the conclusion that the net worth number that really kind of, quote, buys, unquote, you the ideal level of happiness, and it depends where you live. Depends what
right.
your expenses are. Now, if you live in New York City or California, this number's got to be higher. But if you live in the Midwest or the Southeast, this number is going to be fine, right? Here's the number. I bet everybody's waiting with bated breath, and I want to hear what you're going to say. What is the number? Is it 1 million? Is it 10 million? It was about $1.5 million net worth, 1.5. That was the number they came up with. And that was, of course, before real estate prices doubled.
Right.
So maybe that number needs to be adjusted. It went up, and then now it's back down a little bit. What are your thoughts on that?
I do think it has a lot to do with the point at which people feel that they're not worried anymore. Now, of course, what happens for people, you know, there's a keeping up with the Joneses thing that happens for a while. You know, if you're making $50,000 and then suddenly you're making $100,000 a year, you don't necessarily feel twice as wealthy because your expenses generally go up too, right? You move into a nicer neighborhood, you buy a nicer car, and that happens for a while, and that keeps progressing. You know, there was an article in the New York Times that was interesting not too long ago that was very controversial about basically how rough it is for the ultra rich in New York because they have such huge expenses, and they are staggering. I mean, if you think, because you have to have a house in the Hamptons, and you have to have, and if you look at all these costs, but there is that sense of, right, that it's sort of, and my guess is that somewhere around that point is where people are feeling like they can breathe. They really, it's not hard to keep up anymore, and they can maybe relax a little bit. There's also a lot of research showing that sort of money, you know, the ideal way to kind of make people happy is to take money out of the equation. Sometimes, so in other words, you have, but in order to do that, you have to make the amount of money so big. Dan Pink talks about all this about with motivating employees, that the idea about taking money out of the equation is basically pay them really, really well. And then money is no longer something they're kind of worried about. And so you open up all this mental space for creativity and innovation and, you know, really enjoying their jobs, because you've kind of taken that out, which is usually something people tend to kind of fret over. So, you know, I think there is probably a wealth point at which people sort of don't worry quite so much. And that opens up space mentally for all these other things that really are kind of enriching. And that would be my guess.
I would agree with you. And I would say that one needs to get to the point in the money game where money buys margin, where you have this margin of comfort, the cushion, that you
right.
don't have to worry about things, and that you have freedom and autonomy from everything. And I say that the things are, it's really a paradoxical time we live in, because, you know, I'm an economist, okay? And things are deteriorating in many ways, and I think they will get a lot worse for some, but for others, they are accumulating more and more, and it's really kind of sad to see the middle class going away in this country, because I think it's been such a stabilizing factor. But yeah, no, I think that's a really good way to look at money. And the only other comment I would have, and would love to get your thoughts on, is that I think when, and I've noticed it at times in my life when I've been successful, sometimes all these things you buy really become more of a burden and a ball and chain on you than a pleasure. You know, I used to have a big yacht, and it was just a big hassle.
I know,
frankly.
You know, you don't. Yeah, it is a burden. It's a responsibility then. It has to be taken care of.
The things you own start to own you. And what I'd say that people want to have in their lives is they want to have that margin, that autonomy, but they also want to use their money to do some good in the world, because that's very gratifying internally.
It is.
And also to buy experiences. experiences and memories. Those are really important things. So one that comes up would be travel is, I think, a good one for a lot of people. It certainly is for me. And experiences and education, things that enrich the soul and the psyche.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, there's actually some very interesting research you just reminded me of looking at another reason why, trying to explain why wealthier people aren't necessarily happier. And there's a very interesting research showing that the more money you have, the less likely you are to savor. And savoring, you know, whether it's, you know, a really great steak or a fantastic vacation or a beautiful sunset, that, you know, that thing we do where we kind of really focus on how wonderful something is and how special something is, that is a very powerful source of well-being. And it turns out that the more money you have, the less likely people are to take the time to savor something because things feel a little bit less special because they're more easily gotten. You know, my mother, who had very little, and she grew up in Germany after the war, and there was almost nothing, you know, very, very poor. And, you know, when she got an orange at Christmas, I mean, it was the most magnificent food experience she had ever had. And she goes, there's no oranges in Germany, so they shipped in, and it was very special and it was very expensive. And, you know, and she said, you know, I almost miss, you know, I don't think I've ever eaten anything in my entire life, and even now having much more money to go to fancy restaurants and things, ever eaten anything as good as that orange, because it was so very special. And so it doesn't mean that when you have a lot of money, you can't engage that experience, but you have to sort of make yourself do it. You have to make yourself aware of, you know, ask yourself, am I taking a moment to appreciate these amazing special things I have in my life? Because it just turns out that if the more money you have, the less likely you are to do it. And you can fix that by just taking time for savoring. And that turns out to be a really powerful way to really kind of access a source of happiness. And the things you're talking about when you say, you know, spending the money on creating experiences, creating memories, that is that kind of using my money to create things that I'm going to really savor and just really get the most sort of bang for my buck out of, you know, in terms of my well-being and my happiness. So I think that is really the absolute best way to think about what the accumulation of wealth in the end should be for. It should be for creating happiness, your own and other people's, you know, that's reciprocal. You create happiness for other people, it creates more happiness for you. So you just have to think about what you do with it is always, you know, what matters.
Yeah, no question about that. And, you know, there's a great quote about it, and forgive me because I'm going to totally butcher this, but it's something to the effect of, as you climb the mountain to success, in other words, that's the metaphor for moving toward your goal, stop and enjoy the view along the way, because there are many great things to see as you're doing that. And that's part of it. That makes
Absolutely.
It a much more fulfilling experience. So we've got to just keep in check that the money doesn't become the master. I think that's really the way to look at it. It is important. No one can deny the importance of it, but
it's
let's
an instrument
keep it in check.
To something
yeah,
else. It's
right.
An instrument, not the end in itself. And I think that then you keep things in perspective, and then you can do it. It's for your own sake. You know, it's for, you know, maximizing your own happiness. It's just the best way to think about it.
No question. Well, hey, let's not focus totally on that prosperity, money, wealth aspect. Let's talk more about the science of how we get ourselves to
Sure.
achieve our goals, whatever they are, whether they be to be more healthy and fit or to make more money or to do whatever.
Well, you know, I think one of the first things you learn when you start studying this and looking over, people have been studying motivation and achievement for 50 years, and when you start looking at past studies and doing your own, one of the first things you realize is that the one big mistake we make, that people make in general, but nobody makes this mistake more than Americans do, is thinking about ability as really fundamentally the cause of success and failure. And by ability, we usually mean something like innate ability, right? So we see someone who's just just amazingly successful, and we think prodigy. We think, oh, genius. This person is a genius. And by that, we usually mean something like they sort of won the DNA lottery, right? And so they were born to win. And that turns out to be wrong in two ways that are both very important. First is that ability doesn't work that way. So really, nobody wins the DNA lottery. It is true that your genes play a role in shaping your temperament. They shape what kinds of things you find interesting. That tendency. Not everybody thinks math is fascinating, but in fact, everybody can do math. This is one of the ones that drives me the most crazy. You constantly hear people say, "I'm not a math person," or "I am a math person." There's no such thing as a math person. You know what there is people who like math, and so they do a lot of it and they get good at it. and people who don't like math or are frightened of math or have convinced themselves that they're not a math person, so they don't put in the time, and then they're not good at it. Right? So ability is profoundly malleable, whether you're talking about intelligence, creativity, athletic ability. I mean, we just find no matter what ability we study, that it turns out to be just profoundly, profoundly malleable. It's really just so influenced by your effort and your experience. So that's one way in which that kind of thinking is wrong. And the other way in which it's sort of even more wrong is that actually, sort of ability in general has very little to do with who succeeds and who fails. What we find is that the difference between, say, someone who succeeds at losing 10 pounds and someone who doesn't, or someone who succeeds in getting a promotion and someone who doesn't, whatever the goal is not usually that one has ability and the other doesn't. It isn't even that one person knows what to do and the other one doesn't. They both know what to do, but only one of them can actually get themselves to do it. And that's really where a lot of the strategies that I talk about in the book kind of come into play. Because with what Bob Sutton has called and other psychologists have called the knowing-doing gap, right? That we know what we should do, and we just don't seem to be able, and we feel like we want to do it, by the way. You know, we feel like we really are. We're committed, and we just can't get ourselves to do it.
You know, Heidi, there's a great saying for that. And for 20 years, I have loved this quote. It's a Zen quote, and here it goes. To know and not to do is to not yet know.
Exactly, right? Because there is a knowledge that's missing, and it's that knowledge of how do I get myself to do the thing that I want to do.
So how do we
approach it, I think, partly, you know, part of the problem is we think, okay, well, I just need to really get more committed. Well, commitment is very important. You know, you really do need to really want a goal, especially if it's a tough one. But commitment predicts less about success than we think. It's sort of necessary but not sufficient, right? In the philosopher's terms. It's something you have to have, but it's not enough. We find on average that about 50 to 80% of the time, depending on the kind of goal it is, people have plenty of commitment and they fail anyway. So it's not that you're not committed. It's not that you lack ability. There's nothing wrong with you. It's not that you lack willpower. Willpower doesn't work that way either. You know, nobody is born with lots of willpower and other people don't, right? So it really turns out to be sort of, okay, I need to get myself to do this thing, and you have to recognize what the actual obstacles are. And they tend to be very simple things that we don't do. One of them is we don't get nearly specific enough when we think about our goals. So we tend to think, human beings in general just sort of like to think in abstract terms. We like to think, I want to be successful. Well, what does that mean? You know, we tend to, you know, sort of live at this sort of higher level of thinking. And we really, to be very successful in terms of reaching goals, you need to break things down. It's not enough to say, I want to lose some weight. How much weight do you want to lose? You know, it's not enough to say, I want to be richer. You know, I want to have more money. Well, how much money? Exactly. And by when? How much more money do I want to have and by when? Because, those differences, part of the reason, there's a lot of reasons why this is important. One of them is that it's very difficult to know what action to take if you haven't gotten specific about what the goal is, right? So you don't know what the next step is if you're not sure about exactly what the end state is that you're going for. The other reason it's really important has to kind of do with the way our brains are wired. We feel like when we think about reaching goals and setting goals for ourselves, we feel like it's a really conscious, deliberate process, right? I'm setting a goal for myself and I'm thinking it through. And it turns out that the vast majority of the actions we take in order to reach goals happen unconsciously, in the sense that we're just not aware of them. You know, all throughout your day, you're doing a million things to reach it, you know, all the different goals you have, and you're not necessarily aware at every moment that you're doing something in order to kind of get closer to your goal. If you stopped and thought about it, you'd be aware of it, but we don't because we're busy, right? So your unconscious mind, which is most of your mind, is handling these things for you, and it's a great system. You know, it's how you can get in your car to go home at the end of the day and be preoccupied thinking about something, and then the next thing you know, you're in your driveway, and you think, I don't even remember driving home. Well, you know, your unconscious mind handled that for you because it knew where you were going, and so it took you there, right? So our brains are kind of amazing. The thing is, you really want to take advantage of all of that processing power. And to do that, you need to kind of talk to your brain in its own language, right? And it needs to know what the specific goal is. If it knows you have a specific goal, like losing 15 pounds, getting a promotion, driving home, then it knows what to do. Whether you're thinking about it or not, it can actually take the steps that need to be taken in order to get you closer to your goal.
Okay, so then what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that we need to focus on talking to our brain in the language it understands.
That's right.
And does that mean we need to program our subconscious mind? I mean, certainly
It's very simple. No, you know, it's not even anything that elaborate.
Okay.
By simply just taking the time to say to yourself, okay, I know I want to get ahead at work. What do I mean by that? What would success look like? How will I know? And the question I tell people to ask themselves is, how will I know when I've succeeded? If you say you want to be richer, and I say, well, how will you know when you've succeeded? People kind of look at you like, I'm not really sure. Well, if you can't answer that question, you haven't gotten specific enough, right? Because you need that end state in mind. Once you've kind of narrowed in on the end state that you're looking for, then your brain does the rest. That's all it needed. It needed to know. It's like trying to program a GPS without putting in a destination. It doesn't know where to go. And your brain is exactly the same thing. So until you kind of get that destination clear in your own mind, you are missing out on a lot of brain power that could be working for you. So getting specific is one big thing. And then the other big thing, you know, among the strategies I talk about in the book, one of the most powerful ones is something I call if-then planning. But the basic idea is that to not only do we need to get specific about the goal, we need to get specific about the actions we're going to take in order to reach the goal and when and where we're going to take them. It's sort of like not enough to make a to-do list. Everybody likes to-do lists. They're great. But the problem is that most people's to-do lists don't actually include when and where they're going to actually take each of the steps to complete the action item on the to-do list. So nothing ever comes off the to-do list, right? Because you just go, oh, yeah, I forgot I wanted to do that. And it doesn't actually happen. So we miss opportunities to act on our goals all the time. So it's really about, you know, it's, again, taking a little time and thinking, okay, if I really want to, you know, get a promotion, these are the concrete steps I'm going to need to take in order to make that happen. When and where am I going to take those steps? Planning it out. Like, I'm going to need to meet with my boss more regularly. Okay, when are you going to do that? When are those meetings going to happen? Break it down, and then it's amazing. We find that when people do this, when they break their goals down into steps and add that when and where information, like, and this is when I'm going to do it, and this situation is when I'm going to do it, they're on average about 3 times more likely to reach the goal.
Sure. So chunking the goal, having a roadmap. You know, I talk to my real estate investor clients about having a 5-year plan. What are the steps along that way? You know, the old saying, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Most people,
right,
they look at these goals as some big thing out there, like in the distance, and someday my ship is going to come in, rather than
the
daily doingness of
the nitty-gritty.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Exactly.
It's not sexy. All that nitty-gritty is not sexy.
It's not how we like to think, but it's how successful people do think. And they make themselves do it because they see the results. They know that, often just sort of intuitively, they know, hey, when I do this, when I really break things down for myself and I say, okay, these are the steps and this is when I'm going to do them, and I plan all that out, they're much more successful. And we find, I mean, just to give you a fun example, there was a study that we did where we took a bunch of people who were all not regular exercisers but they wanted to be. And we said, okay, we took half of them, and they were all joining a gym, and we took half of them and we said, okay, when are you going to exercise each week? Because they all said, I want to exercise at least 3 times a week. And half of them, we just said, okay, when are you going to do it? And they could say whatever they wanted to. And so we said, well, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday before work, or whatever they liked. And then we came back a month later and looked at who was still exercising regularly. About 32% of the people who didn't make a plan were still exercising. 91% of the people who made a plan, we're still exercising. So, I mean, that's huge, right? From taking a moment to stop and think about, when am I actually going to do this? I want to exercise regularly. I want to meet with my boss more. I want to put away more money in investments each month. Okay, when is that going to happen? How much money are you going to put away? When are you going to do it? What's the system you're going to use? And be very firm about it. And you get typically like a 300% increase in success. I mean, it's just, they're amazing, and they're so simple. Part of why I've gotten into doing all this blogging and writing, and is really like, I when I read about these things and I started doing these studies, I thought, people have to know about this. This isn't hard. You know, this is not a difficult strategy to use, and it's so effective. And it really gets right at what the real problems of goal pursuit tend to be. It's not that you lack ability. It's not that there's something wrong with you. It's that, you know, you're having trouble getting over that gap between what you want to do and actually doing it, which, by the way, we all have, and you just need the right information in order to help you kind of bridge that gap, and it really works.
Do you want to talk anything about self-sabotage and why that occurs? Because, I think that comes into play. It's kind of like what you said before. A lot of people know what to do, but they just don't do it, and you outlined some of the reasons for that, but...
Yeah,
you know, they also kind of shoot themselves in the foot along the way. Is that because maybe one feels that they don't deserve the outcome, that they don't deserve the goal?
I think that can happen. I think the bigger, when you look at the research on self-sabotaging and self, sometimes we call it self-handicapping, right? When people kind of set themselves up to fail, you know, why does that happen? One of the biggest predictors of that actually has to do with insecurity about ability. So you find in the classroom, for example, that students who are concerned that the, you know, who believe that ability is sort of a fixed thing, right? You're kind of born with it or you're not, and they're concerned that they might not have enough, will intentionally not study. And the reason they'll do that is because that way they know they're going to fail the test. But when they fail the test, they can blame it on not having studied, which psychologically is less painful than having to run the risk of actually studying really hard and then still failing and having to say, it's just that I'm not smart enough. So we find that in general, people self-sabotage in these situations where they feel they are, that if they really tried, they would be able to judge something about themselves that can't be changed. Now, again, that's wrong-headed thinking, because there's really almost nothing about ourselves that can't be changed. I mean, people have pretty stable personalities and things like that, but, you know, in terms of abilities, there's nothing you can't improve on. So I think that's sort of that part of the problem is that you kind of, people who go into situations thinking, you're either creative or you're not. You're either good with money or you're not. You're either a risk taker or you're not. And then they think, if I try really hard in this situation, I'm going to find out. I'm going to find out what I am, and maybe the answer is not going to be good, so I'll just avoid that. And it's like, you know, it's trading one pain for another, but they find that the pain of failing is easier to swallow than the pain of really kind of revealing something about themselves that they would find deeply humiliating, and it's a shame. You know,
that's really sad.
Never a good thing.
It's really sad.
It is because you're always, we find that it's really one of the biggest predictors of who handles difficulty well and who doesn't, turns out to be this mental mindset that people have when they're performing any activity or kind of pursuing a goal, whether they think it's about validating their ability or it's about sort of developing ability. So when people go into some situation, you know, a new job, and they think of it as, well, you know, I know I'm not going to be great at this at first because there's a learning curve, but I'm going to get better at it over time. And so when things are difficult, they handle that difficulty much more easily. It's not that upsetting to them because they kind of expected things to be difficult, but they see themselves as growing over time. Other people get into that new job and immediately think, everybody's judging me. Everybody's judging me, and I'm judging me. Can I do this? Do I have what it takes? And everybody else is looking at me and saying, do I have what it takes? And so now the whole thing becomes about, do I have the ability or don't I, rather than this is an opportunity for me to develop my ability in a new area, which is really exciting. And that mental shift turns out to be just really, really powerful. And it's the people who feel they're being judged who do the self-handicapping. And again, being judged by others or even by yourself. They want to avoid the judgment, so they do something to themselves like not bother trying. And I think it's a shame because you're always, every time you take that road, you're selling yourself short. And so one of the things we work with in schools a lot now, we've developed a lot of interventions trying to teach kids to think about intelligence and other kinds of abilities as malleable things. We're trying to kind of combat this sort of cultural story that's out there that we kind of think about people as high ability or low ability. And sort of say, that's actually not what the evidence suggests. That's not how ability works. And we find that when we can get into situations and teach these kids, you know, no, actually, ability doesn't work that way. It can grow. You see amazing differences in their in their math scores and their English scores. I mean, you just see them having a totally different attitude towards school. So, you know, hopefully over time, eventually, we'll kind of get people embracing this idea that we have to put aside our old ideas about what abilities are like, and then we'll hopefully see a lot of this self-sabotaging behavior, you know, start to disappear.
Good points, good points. Well, how would you wrap this all up for people, Heidi? I mean, is there any actionable steps that you want to recap or things you didn't mention that can just help people get what they want, achieve their goals, be more successful and fulfilled?
As I said, I think that the very first thing is to sort of put aside this idea that the reason that you've had difficulty with something in the past has to do with something you lack, you know, some critical quality that you don't have. We just simply find that that is not ever the case. It really is about what you do and you don't do. And there's a lot of strategies I talk about in the book. They're kind of good for different kinds of things. There's willpower strategies you can use for resisting temptation, all kinds of different strategies for tackling different problems. But the most powerful things I can say right off the bat are really get specific about what you want to achieve. Really be able to answer that question. I'll know when I have succeeded when. And have that a clear visual in your mind, because that's going to, again, just engage all of that processing power of your brain that may have not been engaged before to help you address this problem. And then really when you break it down into the steps you need to take, really take that extra step and think about when and where you're going to take each step. And that's called if-then planning. So if I'm in this situation, this is what I'm going to do. If you actually take the time to do that, you're going to increase your chances of success about threefold. So it's the best 5 minutes you could possibly spend to increase your chances of reaching your goals.
Good stuff. Well, Heidi, where can people get the book and learn more?
Oh, as I say, anywhere books are sold. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I also have another short ebook that I just put out with Harvard Business Press a couple of months ago called 9 Things Successful People Do Differently that also talks about sort of 9 of these key strategies that people can use. And you can find that on Amazon as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Heidi. And did you have a direct website that you want to give out?
Yeah, I do. It's just my name. My website's called The Science of Success. The address is www.HeidiGrantHalvorsen.com. And that's where I put all my blogging and videos and interviews and things. And so you can find lots of things that I've written about motivation across a whole bunch of different topics that, you know, definitely check it out.
Well, Heidi, thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope everybody has learned some good things that will help them be more successful and fulfilled and just happier in life in general. So thanks again for sharing this scientific research with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.